This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 8th of January, these are our main stories. The US President-elect Donald Trump has refused to rule out using military force to take control of Greenland and the Panama Canal. The social media giant Meta is ending fact-checking on Facebook and other platforms, saying it wants to prioritise free expression over censorship. The outgoing US Secretary of State has accused the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces of committing genocide in Sudan. Also in this podcast,
I was up on Everest and my tent was shaken very hardly this morning. So I woke up to realize I was surrounded by avalanches coming down the mountain.
We meet the climber who spent an earthquake on the side of Mount Everest. US President-elect Donald Trump has ramped up threats to seize control of the Panama Canal and Greenland, saying he can't offer assurance that he wouldn't use military or economic coercion. He also said eliminating the artificially drawn US-Canada border would be beneficial to national security. And his intervention comes on the day that his eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., visited Greenland, an autonomous Danish territory in the Arctic. While answering a journalist's question during a news conference in Florida, it was difficult to separate humour or bombast from genuine policy. Just how likely is it, then, that the next president of the United States will try to take these territories with military force? A question for our North America correspondent, Neda Torfik.
I don't think he would. I think he is making these statements as sort of leverage. Look, when you look at Greenland, as an island in the Arctic, it's very strategically placed. He's seeing Greenland in the sense that it's part of that geopolitical tension and competition with China and Russia, who have their eyes on the Arctic, of course. Greenland also has rich minerals, which would certainly be very beneficial to the United States. So certainly when Donald Trump makes these statements, you kind of understand that he is thinking about projecting, as I say, again, strength in terms of competition with China and Russia. It's interesting that this also comes as his son, Don Jr., is in Greenland. He's saying he's there just as an outdoorsman on a personal trip. But it does give a little bit of kind of trolling, doesn't it, from the Trumps. And when you look at Panama, again, Donald Trump again complained today that Panama was ripping off the United States by charging U.S. ships higher rates than other countries, that the canal was being operated by China. The authorities there have denied that, but clearly China does have an interest as well in the Panama Canal, and Donald Trump doesn't like that. So again, these comments really do have to be seen in light of how he wants to position the United States against Russia and China in the future.
As you say, it was in response to a reporter's question. Did he plan to say this, or was it something that he came up with on the spur of the moment?
Look, Donald Trump in these press conferences really does speak kind of on the fly. He doesn't have many scripted remarks. I don't think it's something that he would have stayed away from saying in the future if he felt like it would help him. Again, he knows how to grab attention, how to grab headlines, how to get media attention. And so I think that was a very calculated answer to that question to project strength.
Neda Torfik. So let's hear what Donald Trump Jr. had to say to reporters when he flew into Greenland.
Just here as tourists, seeing it, looks like an incredible place. We've been talking about going for a while. I was actually supposed to be here last spring for some of the stuff I do in my free time, but just really excited to be here. Awesome country. The scenery coming in was just spectacular. So just very excited to be here. Thank you.
Trump.
He says hello.
Okay.
We were talking to him yesterday, so he says hello to everyone in Greenland.
The debate over the territory's future has largely excluded its people, many of whom have a fierce desire for independence. Mark Lowen spoke to two residents of Greenland, Klaus Iversen, who was born in Denmark and moved to the island 16 years ago, and Aga Nirviana, who has Inuit heritage, the indigenous people of Greenland. Just what does Aga think about Donald Trump's bid to buy her homeland?
Both entertained and also a little terrified. It's more the attitude that the people, the Inuit of this country are not being asked, but it seems to be a conversation about us with Denmark, which is not the case. It's a negotiation and it's not like a purchase of us and our people.
I have to say, I think it's actually very offensive. Maybe Trump is actually quite transparent in what he's doing, but it's not okay the way he does it. He sees it just as a place where he can go and he can do whatever he wants, but there's the people living here. 56,000 people is living here, and of course, it's up to the Greenlanders. What do we want to do up here? That's not up to him to decide.
It seems like a kind of an absurd proposition that one country can just say, I'm going to buy the territory next to me.
It's important to say, as it is now, there's a commonwealth between Denmark, Faroe Island and Greenland. And it's up to Greenland if they want to develop as an independent country in the Commonwealth or leave the Commonwealth. It's not up to America, it's not up to Denmark.
Akka, what do you want for the future of your land?
The end goal for everyone is independence, and also for me. I'm still conflicted on how, but I think it will always be a negotiation with us and not about us.
Why do you want independence?
You have former colonies all around the world, and the natural process is to reach independence and also having our own voice, holding our own microphone.
I grew up in Denmark, obviously. Been living in Greenland for 16 years, so I love Greenland. And I also love the Danish king, and I'm very loyal to the royal family. If Donald Trump comes with an offer, then Denmark maybe should come with a better offer.
I saw that the King of Denmark has changed the coat of arms to make the polar bear of Greenland more prominent. I mean, you know, do most Danes want to keep hold of Greenland, would you say?
The king, he understands what Greenland is, and he has been here a lot of time. The majority of the Danes, they know there's something called Greenland. They know it's up there somewhere in the north. But the Commonwealth doesn't mean that much to Danes in their daily life as it does up here, because we are kind of the little brother in this game.
What is being part of the Danish Commonwealth? What does it mean in today's Greenland?
It is both colonialism, but I also think we can't just ignore like this common history we have for over 300 years with the Danes, because it's also tied in families. Opening up the debate, it's a good thing, but it's also kind of dangerous, really polarizing, because I think people have really strong emotions.
Agga Naviana and Klaus Iversen speaking to Mark Lowen. In our earlier podcast, we covered the first reports of a magnitude 7.1 earthquake which has hit Tibet's southern border with Nepal, killing at least 126 people. That figure is expected to rise as rescue teams battle freezing temperatures and aftershocks to search the rubble of destroyed homes for survivors. Chinese state media said thousands of buildings were damaged around the city of Shigatse. Tibet is an autonomous region of China. Foreign journalists aren't allowed in. Laura Bicker sent this report from Beijing.
Thousands of rescuers are digging through the rubble of remote mountain homes after a strong and shallow quake rattled through the foothills of Mount Everest. They're searching for survivors, even in the dark, as temperatures overnight dip to minus 18 Celsius. China's response has been swift. Dozens of trained search and rescue teams have arrived in the region and are moving from building to shattered building, listening for signs of life as local villagers cradle one another in shock.
Our next priority is to visit each village to assess their situation and determine where a significant rescue effort is needed.
President Xi Jinping called for all efforts to be made to minimise casualties. The Chinese Air Force launched an unmanned drone across the Himalayan plateau to identify the worst-hit areas, as many roads are impassable after being split by the shifting ground. The People's Liberation Army has also arrived to set up makeshift camps, as this captain explained to Chinese state media.
Moving forward, our goal is to ensure that the affected individuals safely endure their first night after the earthquake in the cold plateau.
Earthquakes are common in this region, which lies in a major geological fault line. But this has been one of China's deadliest in recent years.
Laura Bicker. One of the areas affected by the earthquake in the Himalayas was Mount Everest itself, but it's the middle of winter, treacherous conditions for climbing, so surely hardly anyone was there. Well, one person who was is climber Joost Cobusch. He was attempting a solo climb of Everest's West Ridge and was camped on the edge of the mountain when the earthquake hit, as he told Rebecca Kesby.
Well, I was up on Everest and my tent was shaken very hardly this morning. So I woke up to realize I was surrounded by avalanches coming down the mountain.
Goodness. Okay. And so just tell us where you are on Everest, because I think you're on your own as well, aren't you?
Exactly. So I'm trying to solo climb Everest in the winter without oxygen on the West Ridge. So I'm not climbing the normal route. I'm climbing a technical route that is rocky and icy and steep. So I'm in my tent on a granite balcony at 5,700 in a steep wall. And that's exactly when the earthquake hit.
Goodness. Were you worried that you would even be thrown off the ridge? I mean, it's not a very large area.
One of the biggest challenges of climbing Everest in the winter is the extreme wind speed up there. So my tent was very, very well secured. And it's in a spot where I was sure I couldn't be hit by any rocks or ice. So in a way, I felt very safe. But there were big parts of glaciers collapsing and exploding around me. And the shock waves hit me. And, well, some bits of ice hit the tent, and well, let's put it this way, the tent has seen its last expedition.
So just explain the shock waves. How long did that go on for, and what was that like? And also you mentioned the avalanches, but I presume those are still a threat to you at the moment.
Right now, at the moment, I'm actually back to the base camp and I'm in a safe spot. I'm not in that camp anymore. But being up there, it's basically left and right. There are, yeah, big chunks of glacier that are falling down, collapsing, forming avalanches. But also, yeah, it's just like explosion shock waves from this ice collapsing and fine snow particles, sometimes less fine,
yeah,
pushing against the tent.
Well, it's very dangerous. I mean, you talk about ice, but the kind of ice, the impacted hard ice that would be there raining down on you could do you some serious injury.
Absolutely. This could potentially kill you.
I have to ask you this. It's incredibly dangerous what you do. Why do you do it?
To me, alpinism is a journey into the unknown, and I'm very curious about what awaits me up there, and I'm very curious about what I can achieve as an athlete, as a human being, and therefore I'm very much drawn to this.
Joost Cobusch. Residents of a town in the English county of Nottinghamshire have been left scratching their heads and watching their step because of a mystery pile of bananas. A plate of the fruit has been left at exactly the same spot in Beeston every month for more than a year. Steve Nibbs investigates.
In the early hours of the second day of each month, something very strange happens in the town of Beeston. A plate of up to 20 peeled bananas is left on the corner of Abbey Road and Windsor Avenue, piled up in the same way, sometimes with honey drizzled on them. The culprit? Nobody knows. The phantom fruit leaver has never been revealed or left any clues to their identity. The bananas appear outside Claire Short's house, a local campaigner for clean streets. She recently put up a sign politely asking those responsible to stop. But come the second of this month, the bananas were back.
So I've asked around in the local community. No one can tell me anything. Some people think it's a ritual. Some people think it's just a thing. I could leave this the first few days. The pile of bananas is okay, and then it gets very soggy and the plates get broken and kicked around the pavement, and those I will clean up. And I'm still mystified. I'd love to know who's doing this.
Some residents are upset as the bananas are left to go mouldy and the plates are left behind. But this month, there was an added twist. Taped to the bottom of the plate was a £5 note, a new point of intrigue and mystery in this unappealing saga.
Steve Nibbs. Still to come,
Well, that's not on.
Yes, it's on Australian.
It's on Australian. Thank you, Prime Minister.
Everyone owns the beach. It's a place where every Australian is equal.
Australia's Prime Minister weighs in on using cabana tents to reserve the best spots on the beach. America's tech giants are on the march, just days before the return of Donald Trump to the White House and hot on the heels of Elon Musk's online outbursts against some of America's erstwhile European allies. X's rival Meta has announced that it's abandoning the use of third-party fact-checking on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. Indeed, it says it will rely on community notes similar to those used on X, where commenting on the accuracy of posts is left to users. This is how Meta's chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, explained the move.
The problem with complex systems is they make mistakes. Even if they accidentally censor just 1% of posts, that's millions of people. And we've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship. The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point towards once again prioritizing speech. So we're going to get back to our roots and focus on reducing mistakes, simplifying our policies, and restoring free expression on our platforms.
The move has already been discussed by X's owner Elon Musk, who responded, "Cool," on his platform. For more on the change and its significance, here's our chief technology reporter, Chris Vallance.
It is an extraordinary shift, a sea change almost, in what we're hearing from Meta. We're all familiar with tech companies telling us about all they do to fight things like misinformation. Now, Mark Zuckerberg, the chief executive of Meta, which owns Instagram, Facebook, Threads, is saying fact-checking has gone too far. There's been mission creep and it's resulted in censorship. He says it's time for the company to get back to its roots in free speech. Now, it's no coincidence that this is being said at the dawn of a second Trump presidency, because there has been a narrative on the right that efforts to fight misinformation have effectively resulted in the censorship of right-wing voices. What we're seeing here is, in a sense, a sort of an adjustment. Mark Zuckerberg may well believe that there's too much censorship, but at the same time, it doesn't hurt now that he is looking at working with President Trump and Elon Musk, who described himself as a free speech absolutist, of course.
So just tell us how this new system's going to work, because they're sacking their very own fact-checkers, who they appear now to have lost confidence in, and replacing them with an army of not even volunteers, just anyone who wants to take issue with a fact that's going to be on one of their platforms.
Yes, and this is the system that effectively works on X. It's called Community Notes, and as you say, it is users adding notes to posts that they believe are erroneous. Of course, many people would argue it doesn't work particularly well on X, and it's not going to work particularly well on Meta. It's going to result in more misinformation going through. Of course, other people would say less censorship, but we've heard from one of the organisations that is at the moment a third-party fact-checking organisation, Full Fact, their chief executive, Chris Morris, has said, "We absolutely refute Meta's charge of bias. We're strictly impartial. We fact-check claims from all political stripes with equal rigour." Part of what Mark Zuckerberg had to say was that he looked forward to working with Donald Trump to take on governments around the world, and particularly mentioned Europe as, in effect, trying to censor free speech and censor American companies. He looked forward to pushing back against that.
So is this nakedly Mark Zuckerberg just trying to get close to Donald Trump, who's going to ultimately be his regulator for the foreseeable future?
I think two things can be true at once, can't they? I mean, he can believe genuinely that there is too much censorship, the fact-checking, etc., has gone too far, they need to get back to free speech. He can believe that. And also, it can be convenient for him to get close to Donald Trump. I mean, he spent the day before Thanksgiving dining with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. You know, Nick Clegg, a former centrist British politician, has departed. He's been replaced by his deputy, Joel Kaplan, who is on the right of the US political spectrum, who will be taking over his role at Meta. And Meta has recently appointed Dana White to its board of directors, an individual who is seen as close to Trump as well.
Chris Vallance. The United States says members of the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, and allied militia have committed genocide in Sudan. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said he based this on the systematic murder of men and boys and the brutal sexual violence against women on ethnic grounds in Darfur. Barbara Platt-Usher sent this report from Washington.
Sudan's civil war is one of unmitigated brutality, Mr. Blinken said. A year ago, he determined that both sides had committed war crimes. Now the U.S. has gone further with a designation of genocide because the Rapid Support Forces and its allied militias had systematically targeted civilians from certain ethnic groups. Mr. Blinken said this did not signify U.S. support or favor for the Sudanese army, declaring that both belligerents lacked the legitimacy to govern the country.
Barbara Platt-Usher. It's just been a very stressful time in India. It always is around now, with the annual civil service examinations and the chance to secure a coveted job in government. Students in the state of Bihar have been protesting for weeks, claiming there were irregularities in the tests. Archana Shukla reports from there.
I'm in Patna and it's early morning on the banks of River Ganga. About 100 students, all in the age group of 18 to 25, are giving a mock test. They are preparing for competitive exams in hopes of a good government job. That's the teacher reading out the right answers and students are marking themselves on the multiple choice questionnaire. It's one of the most extraordinary sights. Most of them cannot afford private training centres and hence have made this public promenade their classroom. They are desperate. Government exams are their only shot at a stable career and they try year after year. But their dreams are crushed each time by cheating scandals and frauds where question papers are leaked for money. 25-year-old Akash Kumar, a graduate, works by day and studies for a police recruitment exam by night. But in the last 2 years, papers were leaked and exams cancelled.
If paper leaks keep happening, poor students will never be able to realise their dreams of becoming officers. My father works as a construction worker, but hopes I will get a government job so my family doesn't struggle for daily wages anymore.
Competition is fierce. Millions are vying for a few thousand government jobs. Hundreds of miles away, a sleepy village in Uttar Pradesh bears testimony. In a quiet house, Lakshman Pal Singh sits, grieving. His 26-year-old son struggled to find a secure job for years. Last February, he was one of around 5 million who took an exam to fill 60,000 constable posts. But exams were leaked again.
After the paper leak, I consoled him and told him it's okay, but he was shattered. The next morning, he took his life. He had burned all his college certificates. He said his degrees were useless if they can't get him a job. Our only hope is gone. What do we look forward to?
In 2024 alone, 6 major exams were compromised and nearly 10 million students left in the lurch. Enraged, the students have been protesting across the country. As pressure mounted, the government, first dismissive of any failure, has promised reforms. India's Education Minister Dharmendra Pradhan told reporters in December the overhaul could be slow but sure to minimize irregularities. Back in Patna, these students still keep trying. After all, the dream of a better life is all they have to hold on to.
Archana Shukla. A small hilltop village in southern Italy has banned its residents from becoming seriously ill. The mayor of Belcastro in Calabria, on the toe of the Italian peninsula, has ordered people to, in his words, avoid contracting any illness that may require emergency medical assistance. The mayor described the order as obviously a humorous provocation, but he's making a serious point, as I heard from Laura Gozzi.
So basically, the mayor of this town has issued this decree, which lists various reasons why it was brought in. So among them is the fact that around half of the villages, 1,200 residents, are over the age of 65 and so more exposed to serious illnesses. But mostly that the nearest A&E department is a long drive away, so down a long road with a very low speed limit, which means that it would take over an hour to get there from Belcastro. And also, crucially, the village's on-call doctor surgery is only open sporadically and offers no cover during weekends, holidays or after hours. So essentially, the idea is that if you get sick in Belcastro, there's nowhere for you to go.
Is this yet another case of someone who lives in this area trying to focus attention on the gulf in health provision and much else between the poor south of Italy and the wealthy north?
Yes, I mean, the mayor himself has called this a provocation, and he's basically said that by issuing this strange decree, he's managed to focus the attention on the healthcare issues faced by his village and by the region of Calabria. Calabria is one of the poorest, if not the poorest, regions of Italy. It's been riddled with corruption for a really long time now, and the healthcare system has suffered from that greatly. The mafia has got its hooks in the healthcare system of the region. The Italian central government in Rome has done its best to eradicate it by sending special commissioners that go work in Calabria, but that hasn't always necessarily helped. And over the last couple of years, 18 of the region's hospitals have closed down, and half of Calabria's 2 million residents regularly have to travel to other regions to seek medical care. The problem got so bad that a few years ago, the regional authorities enlisted almost 300 Cuban doctors to travel over from Cuba and work in Calabria to staff these hospitals and medical facilities that otherwise are just unusable.
And yet this is one of the richest countries in the world. I mean, what does he expect? What does he want to happen?
I think he wants to attract attention on the issue, and he wants to put his tiny village on the map, which he has done because a number of journalists have descended on Belcastro over the last couple of days. And he wants people to talk about what seems like an unsolvable problem. And, you know, we're talking about it now, so it must have worked.
And what happens if any residents of the village defy his decree and get ill?
That's unclear. That's unclear. And let's hope it doesn't happen at all and we don't have to find out.
Laura Gozzi. Reserving a spot around the pool or on the beach is nothing new, but a growing seaside trend in Australia has sparked a national debate. It's so serious that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has weighed in on the issue. More from our Sydney correspondent, Katie Watson.
It's peak summer here in Australia, and beaches up and down the country are packed. Shelter from Australia's harsh sun is a must, especially with a recent heatwave. But how people do it is causing some controversy. Cabanas or portable sun tents have become all the rage here in Australia. A parasol doesn't cut it anymore. But the large shades have taken on a secondary role, that of bagsying precious space on the sand. The growing trend of erecting the cabana and then coming and going throughout the day is a practice that not everyone is happy with. On Channel 9's Today Show, presenters even asked the Prime Minister what he thought of it.
Well, that's not on.
Yes, it's un-Australian!
It's un-Australian, thank you, Prime Minister.
Everyone owns the beach. It's a place where every Australian is equal, and that's a breach of that principle, really, to think that you can reserve a little spot as just yours.
In the US, some local authorities have restricted the use of cabanas to stop what's known as beach spreading. So far, nothing like that's been introduced here, but for as long as the summer lasts, this debate will continue.
Katie Watson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and the producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.